This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Body Count, the podcast where we believe history doesn't repeat itself. It rhymes, and a proud member of the Big Head Podcast Network. We're here to show you don't hate history, you just hate the way it was taught to you. Only rule when we choose a topic, someone or a lot of someone's generally died. We give you the series of events in a narrative fashion and by the end correlate said story with current events. Now, I'm not PBS Ken Burns or Dan Carlin. If you want a Hoover-esque Just the Facts, Ma'am history podcast, we are not going to be for you, i.e. there will be analysis, opinions, and this is not a lecture. My opinions are my own. Know that today, like all days, I am holding my co-host verbally hostage, so you direct your hate at me where it belongs. It said tragedy plus time equals comedy. No, we giggle at some occasionally rough subject matter. We're not actively trying to offend anyone. You've been warned. If you are okay with all of those things, know, one, that for this episode, I'm not going to be talking to you, so that's going to be refreshing for a lot of you that continue to fill up my email with hate. And second of all, I am joined, as always, by my co-host with the most. Go ahead, Bethany, introduce yourself.
Hey, it's Bethany Skelton. What up? And honestly, I'm excited to have this next person back on again because I too enjoy not listening to you talk, Jessica. I'm just teasing. I learned.
No, you're not.
I love you, but
but I'm tedious and not so clever as you've thought for the last 15 years. We're getting old, Bethany. Yeah. Why not let our guest introduce himself since he's back for a second week in a row, unprecedented for us? Richard, why don't you tell our listeners who you are and what you do?
Thanks both, and the production team, and it's lovely to be back. Yes, I am researching dirty history, filthy history, strange history, stuff you couldn't make up, since I began publishing on anatomy and the search for the soul in the human body in 2007. Recent offerings, Fairies, A Dangerous History, which took me by surprise many a time. The Real Vampires, which I'm going to talk about tonight, and a vampire novel. I'm currently fiddling with the cover, so it's a nice stage to have got to, The Soul of the Vampire, set in the glorious city of Durham. And my biggest offering, I hope to come in a year or so, perhaps, I just need a friendly publisher agent for it, will be a book on ghosts and poltergeists, which has been the strangest learning curve of a career dedicated to the very strange, and has actually come out of this vampire book, as I'll explain. This was generating 8 years ago, and I stumbled on the poltergeist, or the poltergeist ambushed me, along with the vampires, a formidable duo, and I'm still recovering from it and adjusting to it, as I'll explain. So that's the story so far. Details to come.
That's amazing. I'm so excited.
Yeah, we had too much fun. Actually, as we're sitting here now, your first episode has yet to come out. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I think a lot of people that listen to and bear through dealing with me week to week, which, as we all know, can be tedious.
Hello. Look who you're talking to. Yes.
Preaching to the choir, as we would say in the great state of Texas. I know that I am tedious. I know that my need to have everything rooted in something is tedious, but I'm very excited to talk about the book we're going to today. So, Richard, take it away.
Yes, thanks. Please.
Thank you. Thanks both. So, yeah, many, many big chilling surprises as I hacked my way through real vampire country with my vampire hunting kit on my shoulders. And one of the first ones, really, was how old revenants are and how new they can be. So if you take the basic revenant, which doesn't need to drink blood, but is going to be suspected of interfering with the living, of not lying in peace, of possibly feeding on the living in various ways, you go back at least 4,000 years to graves that archaeologists investigated in Bohemia some while ago, and you find various patterns of what they call deviant burials, that the body has been either buried in an odd way first off, or has been disturbed for some sinister reason and reburied. And this will mean things like rocks on the head, rocks on the chest, iron rods pierced through the chest, the skull or head removed and placed between the thighs. There's actually an expression for this in the Icelandic, thigh forked. And this was in fact found in a British church in the 19th century in Yorkshire, inside the church. So yeah, very, very much older than you'd think, and very basic problems at the root of this. The dead doesn't know that it's dead. The dead won't stay still in the grave. And particularly if the person has died of illness, accident, murder, sickness, some sudden death, unnaturally, they're all the more likely to come back. And could find cases like this outside of real vampire country. Tintern Abbey, you might know of, is on the border here between Wales and England, famous for Wordsworth's poem. And at Tintern in the early 19th century, people digging up an orchard pit found a body that had been buried face down. And locals recalled, as they do with the long memories of that kind of culture, a man who went missing. This was him. And he'd evidently been murdered. His murderers feared that he would come back for them, and they took the customary technique of simply burying him face down, so that if he tried to dig his way out, he'd dig his way further into the ground and not to the surface. As for being much newer than you'd think, there's a few startling examples, but imagine you're on the battlefields of France in the First World War. You've got a lot to worry about between the rats, the dysentery, and the people trying to kill you, without having to worry about revenants as well. But British soldiers did. It's on record. It was witnessed. You shot a man, perhaps as a sniper. You killed a man, routine enough. And then you took the trouble, in some cases, to bury him, and to bury him face down, because it seemed that to some, a dead German soldier was just as worrying as a live German soldier. So yeah, these were some of the things either end of the time spectrum that took me by surprise. Something else that took me by surprise is the vampire really needed to get himself a good PR man if he was going to be let through the door of any Hollywood film by security. So it's looking remotely like Edward Pattinson or Bela Lugosi or Christopher Lee were to stalk aristocratically through your Serbian mud village 100 years ago, there was only one reason to be frightened of him, and this was because someone so haughty, formidable, and alien had to be your absentee landlord, whose cruelties were very much of this world, not the next. The real vampire was shabby, was probably bloated with corpse gas, was like a peasant, and was in fact described by a mounted vampirologist, very strange, creepier than any vampire, but Montague Summers' remarks on British revenants from medieval period as one being of frightful corpulence. So finally, all the actors barred from Hollywood vampire films by clauses in their contracts can don their oversized cloaks and rejoice in their frightful corpulence. Because of course, they were swollen by gas a lot of the time, discoloured by it, so they weren't pale. Their teeth are not often mentioned. Their fingernails occasionally, because the skin had shrunk back from the fingers, perhaps making the nails look longer. But apart from failing to look the part, they also failed to behave the part. So Greece is actually a classic vampire territory, not as well known as it should be. And Greek vampires would happily stalk about in sunlight and kill you with a single chilling glance. And on top of that, were known to be, in some cases, vegan. They could happily survive on the milk of goats, but they also had a vegan diet. one vampire on Greek island in the 17th century, which terrified people nearly to death, was suspected because it was found hoarding apples, nuts, and grapes in its coffin. Other vampires were seen, six of them in broad day, in a field grazing on green beans. And along with the other lack of stylization, Greeks who were terrified almost to death of vampires would say in the 20th century, "I never heard of a vampire drinking blood." Along with this lack of stylization, the vampire typically is a creature of the sacred world, and it is required to obey only sacred laws. So it can wander about in sunlight. The one time you want to deal with it, because it has to be in its coffin, is between the end of Vespers on Saturday night and the start of the liturgy on Sunday morning. So that's the time to go for it. And the methods of destruction, again, much less stylized than we'd think. So these were the things you were looking for if you want to spot your real vampire. And then we come to the question of why you would suspect one. A surprising range of causes. The main thing about a vampire really was it was practical. Like a lot of stuff in a hard-pressed rural community, it was practically useful in the sense that it explained almost anything which went wrong. So it was a scapegoat. And if you had an epidemic of disease or come to New England and the scythe of consumption that was hacking people down in the 19th century, disease unexplained, particularly of the young, any problems with farming, your livestock, your crops, and weather was a big one. Too much rain, too little rain, flood, drought, the very specific ritual. Sometimes in Russia, you take the corpse out and pour water over it to bring water. In Britain, a while ago, they found a revenant with its tongue cut out. And it seems very likely that with the floods that archaeologists identified, there's a kind of magical desire to stop the vampire drinking excessively, which had caused the floods. So these are some of the causes. You could also inherit vampirism. You could inherit it. There was one Romanian aristocrat who, I believe, ended up in Paris in his later years and gave very precise instructions that he was to be dismembered after death because his family was cursed with genetic, as it were, vampirism. More mundanely, there was a servant called Theodore, who we know of because two British army officers, Sinclair and Brophy, very bluff imperial Protestant types, woefully out of place in the Bulgarian village of Derekiwoy in the 1860s, had this young servant Theodore, whose father had been a vampire. So one meant they talk about Theodore giving up drink and smoking on the hope that this will expiate the sins of his vampire father and stop him inheriting it. However, people are taking no chances. And in a cruel kind of Romeo and Juliet meets Twilight scenario, Theodore falls in love with one Miss Tutorica, who has heavyweight parents. Their parents are the local landlord and assassin, respectively. And they forbid Theodore to marry Miss Tutorica and produce some vampire offspring. Theodore thinks about this for a while and then takes the rather unwise sidestep of going for the sister instead. Runs off with the sister Marinka and is finally tracked down, the result being that Marinka's house is burned, Marinka is thrown into prison, and the vampire child that they have produced is put to death. So what else would cause a vampire? A big one and a surprising one was the failure to decay. In Greece, you quite routinely, there's nothing morbid about this, you routinely exhumed a corpse to inspect it and make sure that it was decaying properly. If it wasn't decaying properly, then you suspected a vampire. And in several cases, people's life history was rewritten simply because their corpse hadn't properly decayed, so they became a vampire. And one girl, as a woman in America, talks with absolute horror about being a child and this vampire corpse being put outside for everybody to watch for days on end to be warned about it when she was in Greece. So, yeah, the failure to decay was much more terrifying than any kind of, you know, corpse in a state of slimy putrescence and maggots and so forth. And most of all, Greece was terrified of excommunication. The priests were actually murdered for the belief that they might excommunicate somebody. And if you were excommunicated, it was believed that your corpse wouldn't decay. And you come across cases where they exhume a corpse, supposed vampire, completely undecayed. They persuade some patriarch or priest, whatever it might be, to read the reverse the decree of excommunication. And they swear that the moment that it's being read, the corpse crumbles to dust in the tomb as the words are being read out, perhaps hundreds of thousands miles away. What else would cause vampirism? Now, where it gets really interesting, we've gone through kind of classic magical psychology that you need an explanation, you need a sense of power, you need to be able to do something about your problems. And the vampire allows you this in these problems of disease, drought, agriculture, and so on. But where it gets interesting is when we get to sleep paralysis. And this was something that took me on a very steep learning curve. I had never come across sleep paralysis. I'd never suffered it. I'd never heard of it. And suddenly, I started having it. And it goes like this. You're lying in bed, and you wake up and find, to your astonishment and fear, that you can't move and you can't speak. You seem to be, medicine argues, in some kind of in-between state between sleep and waking. Something starts coming towards you from the side of your vision, from the side of your bed. It might be a human figure, it might be a goblin-esque, it might be a cat, but everybody agrees that it's impossible to paraphrase the degree of terror and the kind of sinister aura that hovers around this creature. It gets up on the bed. It seems to actually depress the mattress. You can see everything quite vividly. It gets onto your chest, and it seems to be tremendous weight. The word nightmare derives from a word meaning crush or bruise, mar. The sense of weight, which obviously fits the revenant, the vampire, solid embodied demon, not just an airy ghost. It seems to crush the life out of you. It seems to suck the life out of you, not so much the blood, but one atheist who had this experience, a writer for The Atlantic in, I think, the 20th century, late 20th century, talks about the fact that it wasn't as though his life was at stake. It was much worse than that. It was as though his soul was at stake. So what's going on here? Medical science argues that you are simply paralyzed every night routinely to stop you acting out your dreams. In the old days of saber-toothed tigers and so forth, it was dangerous to draw attention to yourself. And it certainly can be. Lord Longford, a British character here, was woken up by his wife one night when he was banging his head against the furniture and explained that he'd been dreaming about against Martina Navratilova when she'd suddenly returned the ball so hard he knew how to head it back at her, and was seen with a sticking plaster on his head the next few days. Now, I don't think the medical science has quite exhausted sleep paralysis as an explanation, but the thing that I certainly learned first off was that people, this was about 8 years ago, in America, in Britain, in Europe, in countries with the most medical technology, the most money, the most science, the most reason, were utterly scared out of their wits by sleep paralysis, and were very alone in a way that they wouldn't be in a vampire community. So I was teaching supernatural literature to about 12 students, and three of them were people who'd had nightmare experiences when they were kids, really, teenagers. It happens a lot to teenagers for some reason. And they had no help. They had no community. They had no sympathy from their parents. They're more or less told to shut up. In one case, the kid was told very violently by his parents to shut up and found out many months later that it was a dark family secret that the family kind of passed and practiced down and suffered from it a lot. This was a kind of new taboo going on.
Wow.
It's got better since then, but certainly the people who described it said that every time it happened, they knew what was coming, but each time it was just as terrifying. Now, my experience here was mild, I think, but interesting. I never had this happen to me before in my life. I never heard of it. When it first happened, I was away on holiday and I was accused of snoring. So I've been expelled to a separate room. I was lying on my back and I had quite a heavy meal late at night, all triggers for a nightmare. And I woke up in this out-of-sequence state, couldn't speak, couldn't move, and there seemed to be a creature of a kind of white noise television snow quality on my chest. It was a sort of humanoid figure about 3 foot tall. And being sturdily rational about this by now, I, in my head, swore at it quite vigorously, off it went. That was pretty much the end of it.
I have to ask, though, really quickly, Bethany, have you ever experienced sleep paralysis? Because I am a long sufferer of this exact thing that Richard is speaking about. Have you ever experienced it?
Yes, but it's not a creature. It's actually incredibly vivid. It's fire. Like, I know what it is, but like, I can't move either. And then when I open my eyes, it's still, I feel heavy and I don't see the fire anymore, but it's very interesting to, I had it a lot when I was a kid. And then actually, like, maybe even early 20s, I remember having this, it's the same dream every time. And every time I try to wake up, I am awake, but like, I can't move either. And the fire is gone and it's something else, but I can't see it. So it's, I mean.
Okay, good. That's what I wanted to establish. I mean, it's something that you and I have never talked about in 15 years of friendship. In and of ourselves. And I thought it was very interesting. I was reading the book this weekend, like the exploration of sleep paralysis with everything else. Long time sufferer, not a fan.
It's not really something you bring up in like conversation. Like, hey, how was your sleep last night? Oh, well, it was great.
You know, really. It was a waking nightmare. How are you?
I do have a question about it was earlier on when you talked about when people would bury bodies,
yeah,
especially murdered or, you know, in war, how they would bury them face down. Is that still something like that's a first for me. I've never heard that. If you bury them face down, they're more likely not to come back for you, I guess.
They dig their way into the earth instead of out of it. But no, I'm speaking for Richard. He's going to be able to explain it much better.
Yeah. What was the question? Sorry, does it still happen? Or the question, why do they do it?
Yeah. Yes. Yes and yes. Like, why is that? I didn't realize that thing, first of all. And we don't still do that, obviously, right? I mean,
I'm sure somewhere in the world it still happens. I think the thing about it that fits all the other evidence is, in vampire country, you're just practical. You know, the vampire looks like what you expect it to look like around you, and you deal with it with the tools you have to hand. So if you don't want to have to burn 11 corpses as they did in Medvijga, in the case of Arnold Powell, which is a lot of fuel in a cold winter, just turn it upside down and bury it. And vampires, in fact, could be surprisingly dim, you know, that they were not plotting the grand Hollywood vampire apocalypse in their turret room castle week by week. They were just beating themselves in rather dull, grisly ways. They're much like a zombie a lot of the time than the Count Dracula vampire. Understand Mark Gatiss is going in search of Dracula tonight, which is good timing. So, yeah, just be practical. just keep it simple. Don't play nice with vampires. If you have to, then you will really keep burning and chopping and keep burning. And the ashes you will throw into a river so that it'll end up on someone else's land, not yours. But it's practical stuff, actually. It's very interesting what you say about the nightmare, and you don't talk about it because they would thoroughly talk about it in vampire country. And I'm quite interested to hear more about what you talk about the fire, but I'll come to, if it's okay, a case resembling that in a moment. The thing I'm interested in here is the degree of terror that sleep paralysis generates in ultra-rational people who say they're atheists, people feel their soul is at stake. And we know the degree of terror and how severe it was because in that case of Arnold Powell in the early 18th century in Medvijga, which was witnessed by the Austrian army, so it's very well documented, they burned their 11 corpses in the end. And one reason was because they felt that, you know, this person's not properly decayed, but also people started having nightmares. And a young woman, maybe about 18, called Stanoka, was having very bad nightmares night after night, the vampire sucking the life out of her. It was actually someone she recognized who died some while ago. And she simply died of terror after a few days. And this I found was a recognized condition which has been labeled voodoo death on the basis that it's seen as primitive tribes. If you've got a belief in magic strong enough, someone points a magic bone at you, the witch doctor, whatever, you break a taboo, eat the wrong kind of food, you'll go into a kind of state of hopelessness, you might foam at the mouth a little bit, you'll refuse all food and water, and you'll die in 1 to 3 days. And the pattern is very similar across centuries, across continents. What hadn't been acknowledged, I think, so much is how voodoo death goes on right in the heart of Europe, up to probably the 19th century, and it goes on with cases of witchcraft. So in Shakespeare's, or just after Shakespeare's lifetime in England, famous play, The Witch of Edmonton, is based on a real case. And when you look at the sources behind it, you realise that there was a ridiculous kind of trivial argument about a pig between two women. One of the women believes the other one is a witch. She believes the witch has cursed her, and she goes home to bed in a fit. She lies down and she dies. She simply dies of belief, you know, at the height of this period of the glories of English literature and art and all the rest of it. Voodoo death in England there. And a witch could do it to you. A vampire could do it to you. And it's an index, I suppose, of how terrifying sleep paralysis can be. Owen Davies, the supernatural researcher, folklorist, talks of a soldier who'd fought in frontline Korea for, I think it was 13 consecutive months. And he said of his one single nightmare attack in 1964, that was easily the most terrifying experience of his life. Now, this raises the question, what actually is going on here? I'll just quickly gloss the nightmare experiences that I had after the first one in the farmhouse, which, by the way, was good old Welsh farmhouse, could have been actually haunted. And it happened to me again, no big deal at all, very blasé about it. I'm used to this, I know all about it, I've reasoned myself out of it. Happened the third time, and point I'll make here is that I could see my room. Now, one spooky thing about this already is people over and over again have said they can see the digital clock turning over, everything looks perfectly normal in the room. If you video somebody in this state, they seem to have their eyes shut. So are they already having some kind of out-of-body experience to be able to see what looks like their normal bedroom? Anyway, my arm, one of them is dangling over the side of the bed. I think it's my right arm, right hand. The left was thoroughly kind of tucked, like military style, under the blankets. No way you could have moved it. And as I'm thinking, oh, it's sleep paralysis, blah, 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 it's going to go away, yeah, go away, go away. Suddenly there is this violent snap of a hand around my right wrist. And where it came from, what it was, I do not know. But it was as real or more real than any kind of Nicely Timed Hollywood movie shocker. And it was as though someone's watching and saying, if you're going to get blasé about this, watch this. So the memoir I'm reading at the moment, which I thoroughly recommend, about a haunted house in Brooklyn in the 80s and 90s, within our lifetimes, if you want to make sure you don't buy that house, that's quite important for one thing. You wouldn't regret it, even if it was 10 cents. now, this memoir by a woman called Elaine Mercado is called Grave's End because it's where she was living. And the main form of terror a lot of the time was nightmare attacks. And interestingly, they were only experienced in the older parts of the house, not the newer parts of the house that postdated the tragedy which had occurred. They were experienced by almost everybody except the younger daughter, and they involved a very, very powerful sense of pressure. You could actually see and feel the mattress depressing. It was really terrifying, and there was particular breathing problems, which you get with this. Now, the fact of the matter is that here, as in one or two other cases I've seen in the Victorian period, it looks like there was a real ghost. There was a real ghost, and the nightmare and the ghost were kind of coming together in this unholy alliance, which I would wonder about given what happened to me only the once. And certainly the biggest thing I learned researching vampires was that although you can explain a lot of it in terms of folklore, magical belief, psychology of control in a non-scientific environment, what you can't explain, and I couldn't, was people saying the vampire behaved like a poltergeist, not just a ghost, but a noisy, disruptive, violent poltergeist, throws you out of bed, bashes you up, will throw stones through the windows, you can't see where they're coming from, and yeah, will fuse with sleep paralysis episodes. So the terror, the mass hysteria you cannot really conceive in these cases. In Mykonos in 1700, the island in Greece, people were fleeing from this vampire poltergeist, which didn't respond after they kind of gouged it open and burned it and pulled its heart out and so forth. They were all going to sleep in the square or fleeing to remote villages and so forth, and finally burned it on New Year's Day on a completely separate island just to be on the safe side. And happy New Year, Mykonos. But vampire poltergeists were the things that set me reading about poltergeists. It was the one thing I couldn't explain. So I end up reading the craziest stuff I've ever read in my life. No contest. 5 minutes of physics makes people's head hurt, makes them angry, makes them laugh. It's beyond all rational bounds. There's information coming at you, flying like poltergeist missiles from all directions. And the very worst thing is not that it's going to give you bruises, but that you have nowhere in your head to put it. You've spent your whole life routinely absorbing bits of information without thinking about it. It's as smooth as you like. It's a process you don't even have to think about. When you do, you get angry, you get bewildered, you get derisive of anybody who tries to tell you that it's happening and so forth. So having read this stuff in the British Library and trying to absorb this craziness, which seems like consistent craziness across countries and centuries and doesn't seem like the kind of archetypal, beautiful, religious, exciting stuff that people would actually make up. I come out and I go to lunch with an old friend, known her for 7 years, and we've been through some heavy weather together. And we start talking about what we're doing. And I say, have you come across poltergeists ever? She goes white, freezes up, silent for a moment or two, and then says, can we go somewhere more private? And we do. And she tells me the story of a poltergeist chasing her from one house to another for 18 months, the most traumatic thing that ever happened to her in her life. She compared it to murder. And she never whispered a hint of it to me in 7 years of quite a lot of shared secrets. I go back to Cardiff from London and raise the story with another friend I've known for 12 years, and he tells me another version of the same thing that he has never whispered to me for 12 years. So at this point, I start to think, when your old friends look you in the eye and tell you stuff like this as well, you need to pay attention. And you also realize that you're dealing with a weird kind of open secret in a world where taboos get broken finally, too late on perhaps, but we know that, you know, someone like Jimmy Savile, someone like Clement Freud, someone like Einstein could be abusing people for a very long time and get away with it in a strange culture of sort of open secrecy. We've created a new taboo, and the worst thing that's ever happened to you, you will not get help, quite the reverse, you will get abuse if you dare to talk about it. I had a book project on this way, way back, and the editor was very keen, and he came back sheepishly after the meeting. So I'm often very rich, and no one believes a word of what you said. So particularly our demos with the poltergeist and the ghost. But here's the thing, that actually, when we believe these superstitious, mad, idiotic, primitive people are talking nonsense, no, in some cases, they're talking the truth, and it checks out with what happens now.
Oh my God. So just really quickly, listeners, while this has all been going on, I'm pointing to me and Bethany. Like this is the first time we've talked about our own sleep paralysis experiences or anything. We've known each other for 15 years through thick and thin, like the worst secrets you can imagine between the two of us. We know where all the...
Never once this a conversation. And mainly, I mean, like I said, like this is in this. So when we talk about, when you discuss the sleep paralysis, it can be a combination. When you experience it, can be a combination of of a poltergeist or a vampire or, you know, whatever crazy, you know, a supernatural kind of like any kind of, I mean, is it common for it to be the same dream or does it usually have to be multiple reoccurring? Like, I'm just curious on how it kind of all pulls together in that kind of sense.
Yeah, it's a hell of a thing to take the different bits apart accurately, really, because you're in very, very shadowy territory. And of course, if it happens to you, you're in particularly shadowy territory. But what I do know is this, that the brain seems to try and rationalize this amorphous kind of shape or evil into something with an identity. And then, ironically, it's a bit less terrifying in one sense. So your local demon will tend to be what you tend to see on your chest. And this will be across history mainly, there's a few, but the big unholy trinity are the witch, the vampire, and the alien abductor. And witches have almost certainly been tried and possibly executed for the fact that somebody said, yeah, that uncanny neighbor that I always knew was a bit shifty down the road was on my chest and like sucking my life out. The alien abductor, as you might know, there was a guy called John Mack, a Harvard professor, a few years ago researching this, and he got into a very interesting standoff with the Harvard Ethics Committee because he came after researching this and interviewing these victims, as it were, of sleep paralysis and alleged alien abduction, to believe eventually that they were telling the truth. Not just that they were telling the truth and that they believed it, but that something had really happened to them. And Harvard couldn't really cope with this. And there was a big controversy with various heavyweights involved in the media, I think, about the fact that he should be left to do his research. So I think in some cases it's quite possible you are just getting some kind of version of sleep paralysis happening to you. And yeah, the more you're stressed, for example, the worse it gets. So the problem here is that you told everybody in vampire country, witch country, everybody got more stressed, everybody had more nightmares, everybody got more stressed, everybody had more nightmares. And one big monster vampire witch snowball rolling downhill until it crushes anyone that gets in the way of it. In some cases, yeah, it is some kind of ghost spirit, some person that isn't dead. And what's interesting here is that when the vampire people say, be careful about someone who dies of murder, accident, prematurely, there's all sorts of causes, but these unnatural deaths are a big one. Well, actually, I would take seriously, and I wouldn't have done so, I would have told you to shut the hell up 8 years ago if you suggested this to me, but take seriously the fact that people who do die violently, suddenly, prematurely, unexpectedly, they don't actually know they're dead in quite important sense. They have to be told they're dead, they have to be sent on, and they will haunt the living in various ways to varying degrees of violence, sometimes just to get attention, sometimes because they feel that someone's in their house, what are you doing in my house? It's a bit of a twisted version of that film, The Others, if you've seen it with Nicole Kidman. So, yeah, there's a lot to kind of take apart in the shadows here, but I feel a lot more aware of what's actually going on now than I did 8 years ago.
So I want to ask, Richard, just because we're taking from you, from Renaissance literature, you've made the journey to modern neuroscience and then the journey into almost theoretical particle physics and astrophysics. Like, how do you feel about that journey?
I feel, yeah, it's great because you might get to 40 years old and think you know everything. You might get to 40 years old and feel very bored. And when you get over 50 and you still feel there's a tremendous lot to learn, then you feel very galvanized, I suppose, by your research. And I feel particularly that it is unfortunate that in a lot of university settings, you couldn't really do this kind of research. You would get a lot of kind of sideways look from colleagues, despite the fact I've had these experiences, and the oddest one in a way was someone telling me they'd seen a ghost when they were a kid, and it very precisely checked out with what I'd read and heard otherwhere, and then denying it later on because they got in a different mood about it and I don't know what I really saw. So yeah, I feel that there's still a tremendous lot to learn. of all, what I feel is that with all the kind of high-tech gizmos, gadgets, meters, electromagnetic, this, that, and the other, infrared that they take into people's houses on sometimes rather silly and sometimes very damaging ghost hunting TV shows, actually, there's one very, very, very powerful tool, and it's as old as humanity, and it is this. You listen to what somebody says. You really listen. And if it's making your head hurt so badly that you're angry, you just take some time and you do some reading, and you find that it corresponds to all sorts of stuff in the literature, but all sorts of stuff that people have got unpublished in their heads, in their families, a big, big story that they're repressing. So, yeah, listen to what people say. And there's been enough lessons already, I guess, in the field of abuse recently to make us realize that we need to do that harder.
I mean, that's probably, that also stems why, again, Jessica, like we talk about from everything under the sun, but when it comes to, you know, our deepest fears and our deepest, like, obviously I have a fear because I have the reoccurring nightmare itself, you know, and it makes you kind of stand back and go, holy shit. But it's not something I'm going to sit down and talk to somebody about. But like you said, it's one of those things that maybe we actually should, because you'll find that it, you know, alleviates the problem, or it might, you know, might find somebody else, and then we start talking about it, and then it becomes an actual thing. You know, I don't know. When you are terrified and scared.
From Renaissance literature to Project Blue Book. There we are. That is where we live in this podcast of anything and everything. No, I don't think it's ridiculous, because here you and I have known each other for 15 years and we've never discussed this until this day. So I find that interesting, and I find that, even though it goes against everything that I understand, and that pretentious fucking vacuum I put myself in, right?
You said it.
summed up in three pithy words. P-E-F-E. I remember that. Yeah, do not look yourself in a pretentious fucking vacuum if you can help it. I've given the best introduction to this whole journey, actually, I think, in another book, The Smoke of the Soul. And point I haven't made here, but I do make in the book, is that my father died very suddenly when I was 20, and I had lots of reasons to believe in religion, but didn't. And what I think is ironic and paradoxical, as Bethany hints here, is that America is arguably, or perhaps surely, the most religious country in the developed world, probably more religious than Italy, for example. And yet you will find people telling you they know the absolute certain truth about everything, from that woman swiping the apple to the last judgment and the trumpets and the resurrected bodies. But they'll look at you a bit sideways if you try and tell them about a ghost or a poltergeist, for which you have got.
Oh, no. She just spit her beer. Oh, none. Yeah, no, we don't do that here. Wait, no, not in religion.
Yeah, no, it's very, very accurate, which I think is very, very interesting.
Yeah, it's the same here, really. People who are very thoroughly Christian will think you're a bit odd, or Christian, you know, hierarchy, priests, ministers are really quite bad at dealing with this or facing up to it until they actually perhaps see it, as somebody did in Cambridge, a Cambridge college, I think it was about 1997, it was staring right at him, and then he had to sit up a bit. I'd love to know what people experience themselves, any listeners, in terms of sleep paralysis, what they think it means, and ghosts, poltergeists. I suspect, actually, that about 30% of people have had a poltergeist experience. In one or two cases, you wouldn't know it because it's so low level, with something just getting moved around over and over again. In a shared house, you'd be getting a bit pissed off with your fellow residents, but you wouldn't know that it was a ghost doing it. So yeah, I'm very much open to that. If you want to hear stuff almost stranger than The Vampire and the Poltergeist, what were the solutions to vampirism? And they were quite varied. Yeah, you could burn the corpse. You could chop it up into pieces. But here's one for you where a young woman was having typical sleep paralysis nightmares. Her dead uncle, Petrotoma, was coming to her every night and sucking the life out of her, throttling her, sitting on her chest. So the villagers knew what to do. Off they went to the cemetery, got Toma's corpse out, decided it wasn't properly decayed, hacked open the rib cage with a scythe, spiked the heart aloft on, I believe it was a scythe again, stuffed some glowing coals into the ventricles until they got some charred flakes, ashes of some kind, or fibres out of the heart, which they wrapped in a tea towel, popped into a glass of water and gave to the girl to drink. Job done, all cured. And this happened in Romania, in Transylvania, you'll be pleased to know, and you might be surprised to know, in 2004, just after Stephanie Meyer had signed her contract for Twilight. In the case of sleep paralysis, when it is perhaps purely psychosomatic, you know, you need to do something, you've done something, right, that's it, off it goes.
Wow. I honestly did not know that it was even a thing. I mean, I understand that you chop people up. I thought just mass murderers did that, honestly. But, you know, to prevent them coming back as vampires, that is also, I guess, a precaution to take.
Lower tech methods of vampire disposal, such as burying face down. You could, in Bulgaria, bottle the vampire. There was a professional vampire bottler who would have the vampire bottle with a holy icon in it, and also some of the vampire's favourite food, this being, of course, excrement. And the vampire bottler would sort of herd, like a sheepdog, the vampire from one point to another until it was cornered into the bottle, whack the stopper down, throw it on the fire, job done. In a Greek mountain village called Ambalios, a pseudonym, but it's actually Evia, not far from the mainland, in probably, I think, the 1930s, everyone was harassed by sleep paralysis and decided that there was a vampire. Interesting reason for this was that you had a very powerful ritual of watching the corpse. The corpse would be in the room for some time. It never must be left alone. People wouldn't go to sleep, so they're very tired. They're all in a circle around this corpse. But unfortunately, there's an absolutely ferocious stipulation that nothing must ever pass across the corpse. So, of course, middle of the night, falling asleep, somebody passes a crying child over the corpse, a cup of coffee, a cigarette, bang, you vampirize the poor person irrevocably, no fault of their own. There's nothing you can do about it. You can't reverse it. And what the villagers of Euboea would do, and they still feared the vampire into the late 70s, early 80s, was this. They would make a hole in the coffin, so they didn't really have to confront the vampire, and just pour through this hole in the coffin a mixture of oil and vinegar. And this boiled the vampire's soul, basically. It destroyed the soul. So something that has delighted me, really, researching fairies, witches, ghosts, magic, vampires, you name it, is that in defiance of all this haughty, orthodox, literate, educated Oxbridge theology, you've just got magic and you are not going to talk anybody out of their magical beliefs, however powerful and educated you are. So if you want a heresy here in the 1930s, possibly believed in the 1970s, they have destroyed the soul. This is a very pious community, but they never again light a candle, say prayers for this person. It's not in heaven, it's not in hell, it's gone. And all you need to do that, listeners, if you want to, try it at home with some oil and vinegar. Very simple, low tech.
What you would put cucumbers in? Put a corpse.
Your own spice, I guess, and your own touches if you're a creative cook. I should not serve boiled vampire at a dinner party, but each to their own. So yeah, these are some of the causes, real, magical, imagined, for vampires. A very mundane but pretty grim cause was that the undead were simply not dead. People were buried alive to a terrifying degree in the past in affluent and civilized society. But particularly, I think, in vampire country, because you, in your fear of the dead, were supposed to bury the person while they were still warm. In some cases, they were still warm because they weren't dead. So when we hear of the vampire feeding itself, not just by eating apples, nuts and grapes, but by gnawing on its own tasty limbs in the it might be because it's actually alive and is starving. And corpses were brought out with these marks of self-mutilation on them in some cases. So what would happen if you believe that your relative was dead nowadays? Well, hopefully family relations are good enough that when they come to life in their coffin, you're going to rejoice and fling your arms around them and so on. Forget the social distancing for a moment there in the epiphany. It would not be the case in Greece in the 1930s, where one person actually sat up in their coffin at the funeral, and the beholders are confronted with a kind of zombie-like, I suppose, quite stunned and sort of slow moving spectre, seized everything they could get their hands on, from rocks to sticks to I don't know what, and stoned the poor person to death, basically back to death. And that was the end of it. Probably partly they were too terrified to actually go any nearer to this uncanny undead thing. That was the kind of pleasant version of it. In Russia, in about 1890, it could get a lot less pleasant. So imagine there you are, literally sleeping away in your grave. The coffin lid is fixed down with crude wooden nails. And you suddenly think, oh, what's that noise? And you can hear earth coming down on your coffin lid and think, hello, I'm not dead. So you force your way out of the coffin. In this case, it was very cold, as it often is in Russia in the winter. It goes on a long time. So you've probably been comatose. And you force your way out of the coffin. Everyone flees, pell-mell, gravediggers, mourners, etc. And you manage to run into the house of one person, a very old lady who's not been at the gravesite, doesn't know what's going on, and try to warm yourself by the stove in your shroud. Next thing you know, the villagers have summoned up some courage. You've got guns, stakes, pitchforks, you name it, and drag you out of the old lady's house, rudely fling you down to the ground and stake you to death, leaving you out in full view in a ritual fashion until sunset, when you'll be thrown into a bog. I guess if you were about 5-10 years old in this Russian village, it will make quite a strong impression on you as a bit of rough and ready education in vampires. Now, that was still the pleasanter version than some. And if we've just got time for this, the one that really made me sit up when I thought I'd seen it all described the prolonged drought. So we've got this vampire scapegoat, which has ruined their crops to the death of a certain old man who is regarded as an oppir or wizard. This is a kind of hybrid heretic vampire wizard of Russia. So it hadn't rained since he'd been buried. They decided that, according to popular superstition, they should exhume his remains at midnight, sprinkle them with holy water with the help of a priest, and put them back in the grave. So on Sunday night, a procession of villagers, headed by boys and girls carrying torches and accompanied by fiddlers and flautists playing dismal dirges, set out for the cemetery. The body of the dead wizard was in a sitting bucket tree, around which 40 or 50 of the peasants danced a weird dance to the accompaniment of the village musicians. Already village vivid stuff here, but now the priest turns up and things get nasty. Father Constantine appears and the villagers rejoice, thinking he's come to help them by sprinkling holy water on the corpse, but find to their surprise and disappointment that he isn't going to play ball and is upbraiding them for their superstition and their sacrilegious barbarity. The crowd at this grew indignant. Some among them, who were under the influence of vodka, shouted that he was the real wizard, as the spirit of the dead man had entered into his body. The priest was accordingly seized, and despite his shrieks for mercy, was hurled by four of the men into the reopened grave, the remains of the corpse being flung in after him with earth and stones. In the morning, the police commissary, apprised by two women who had witnessed the affair, dispatched a body of men to the spot. The Pope was brought up out of the grave and given over to two doctors, who for more than an hour tried to restore him to animation but failed, death having evidently been brought about by suffocation and shock, and we would hope fairly swiftly. So, real vampire country just over 100 years ago, which ready stuff.
Well, Russia never fails on this podcast, guys.
Never disappoints.
It never disappoints. You know, as now are under also the heavy influence of vodka, it wouldn't be Body Count if we weren't. Oh, geez. Richard, like, honestly, I am loath to cut you off. Like, if you have the time to keep speaking, keep regaling us. If not, I will cut the podcast short.
No, that's lovely. There is a lot to say. So I perhaps leave you with a few gems from America, in fact. And at this point, I step right out of character and stop recommending my own books and recommend to you Food for the Dead by Michael E. Bell, from which I derive much of this fairly astonishing information. And it's nice because here we are on the eve of the apocalypse, and I believe Mr. Trump has been decrying unpatriotic history in recent weeks. So I'd like to here by producing some very unpatriotic American history, which,
if anything, I think it is patriotic, sir.
It's kind of a patriotic fence you're standing, doesn't it? Yeah. I think there was a phrase in the history of mobile phone advertising, you might remember, the Orange Company, which they used to joyfully tell you the future was orange. And I'm deeply hoping the future isn't orange any longer. But the unpatriotic history of the New England vampire is quite something. Food for the Dead gives you a lot to go on. Michael is also just putting out soon a new book called Vampire's Grasp, and he keeps turning up crazy, crazy stories. So the vampire in New England was absolutely the scapegoat variety. Consumption was scything down whole families. I mean, when I read about this, it was astonishing. Even at a distance, it's pretty heartbreaking. 13 people in the same family dying of consumption. So the scapegoat was the first person who died, and you went to the grave, you opened it up, you looked at the body, and you didn't need much to convince you. And I suppose what we realize here is you wanted to believe that your first sibling, father, daughter, wife was actually the vampire, because then you had something you could do about the problem. So any amount of kind of fluid, colored tissue, whatever, in the heart, the lungs, you get those out because the vampire was feeding on you from its grave. And this is an interesting thing. The New England vampire superstition probably come from Europe. How transmitted, we don't really know. But it had this variant that it didn't have to get out of its grave. So it could feed on you from a distance. The evidence is there in front of you. Perhaps the corpse might be completely undecayed in some cases. But if you've got these heart and lungs, you take them and you burn them. You then put the ashes in water and you drink them. And there are various instances of this happening right through the 19th century. But my favorite, I suppose, a couple of incidents in America are these. Woodstock, Vermont, in the 1830s, there was a vampire identified in this fashion. And they took the heart and they boiled it in a pot on Woodstock Green, a grand concourse of spectators and beholders. The supposed vampire whose heart was being boiled was one Corwin, and he was the brother of a US senator. And various of the figures around this scene, general this, general that, probably looked, you know, not unlike Abraham Lincoln. So at this edifying, unpatriotic historical scene, they dug a colossal hole in the ground. I think it was 15 foot deep, 10 foot wide, wrestled in a granite weighing several tons just to make sure there's no mere kind of burying it upside down here. And then they sprinkled bullet blood over the earth. I hope this will get filmed one day, because it would really be something that's not been seen on any horror film. A variant of this that occurred also in New England. Much of it seems to be there. There's a few other cases outside of, but a variant was a little while earlier in winter 1793. Hundreds of people are out for the skating in this cold winter, but they're also out to visit the village forge, and they are interested to see a heart being seared like a particularly fat steak. on the forge of the blacksmith Jacob Mee in the town of Manchester, again Vermont. The story, I'm getting a bit hungry at this stage of the night, actually. The story that Captain Isaac Burton had married a woman called Rachel Harris. Rachel went into decline and died about a year later of consumption. Captain Burton, grief-stricken though he was, after another year, married a woman called Holder. Interestingly, to give another twist to this, Holder was the stepsister of Rachel, both women having had the same father. And Hilda now also became ill. And while she was suffering from consumption, a strange infatuation took possession of the minds of her family. And they believed that the jealous first wife was feeding on the second one. Not for me, a mere man, to comment on this in any detail, but the solution was that the guts, organs of the first wife should be burned on a charcoal fire, hence Rachel's heart on the forge while everyone is skating around in Manchester on the outside.
Oh, that is a party.
Right? You've reached new bounds of being an American in that case.
God. Yeah, it's hard to beat. It is.
Oh my God, this is amazing, Richard. As much as I plugged your book, well, I haven't plugged it yet, but we will be plugging it. Your actual last episode is still not out officially yet. It has not dropped. We drop on Mondays in the afternoon. So this last episode that you had has not even dropped officially. And here we are just laughing hysterically at the new one. But also not laughing. I think that, honestly, you've brought us closer as friends, because in talking about this, you highlighted something that we don't talk about, experiences we don't talk about, and experiences that I always have, even myself, the tendency to dismiss from those that I know are far cleverer than myself. Geez. You've brought us full circle. You've changed the thinking, if you will, of us in this podcast. Usually, I try to dip myself pretty heavily in the waters of absolute truth. There is an absolute story. But you've broken us out of that prison for sure for the last 2 weeks.
Thanks. Well, yeah, the statistics on sleep paralysis, I go as high as 40% having at least one sleep paralysis episode. So there must be a lot of other people probably, suffering in silence, not telling their family or not getting any sympathy from their family if they do have this. And I suppose what's interesting is that, like the ghost, like the poltergeist, it's outside the whole spectrum of the possible. You know, it's not just weird. It's not just embarrassing. It's not just dirty or disgusting. It's not possible. And there's something very peculiar about the way our heads fail to deal with that. And what I found interesting in studying ghosts and poltergeists is that children are the most open to them of all. That children are most likely to see them. Children are least likely to be frightened of them. And they're, yeah, I suppose putting it very bluntly, pretty psychic until, you know, age 10, 11 or so.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, if I think about it, you know, I have nightmares, I have dreams. More than likely when I wake up, I don't remember them. I usually remember that I had it, but I can't tell you what it was about. Okay. But yet, my son, who's 9, he can vividly tell me everything that has happened and why it woke him up. He can tell you what time he woke from it. It's very interesting to kind of see that and make a realization as, oh, interesting. You know, kind of,
e.g., my 7-year-old daughter. So, yeah. I completely get that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, if you've got time for just one more.
I have infinite time. Whatever you have time for, we have time for.
I suppose you remind me there that, you know, the lesson I learned is listen to people. But I suppose the people that get listened to the least some of the time are children, because, well, they're not reasonable. They make things up. They tell fibs. But the story that I had purely by chance, and I think that the way these stories come so accidentally makes you realize how many of them there are around you. It's a bit as if, you know, these stories themselves are another dimension, rather like spirits in another dimension, right at our shoulders as we sit here. And I was supervising a student doing a ghost dissertation. So for that reason, got onto this subject. And I said, have you ever come across ghosts or poltergeists yourself? And she says, no. Oh, but hang on, there is this one thing. Now, the family was a family of four girls of quite varying ages who moved from south to the north of England so that they could live in a very big, beautiful old Victorian house. And the house was, it stank of cat's piss was the way they described it more or less. B&B. So a lot of work went into getting it into shape, and often in ghost cases a bit of work or disruption tends to raise a ghost or poltergeist. So they got low-level poltergeist stuff going on for a while, and it was weird and inexplicable. And the people who were witnessing this, incidentally, were a submarine captain and a gynecologist. They weren't woolly-headed new age Glastonburyites, and yet they couldn't really see it with their own eyes. At one point, the husband went upstairs, having come back from a trip away, to see what had been done. There's two rooms nearly at the very top of the house on what we would call the second floor, you'd call the third floor. And there's a corridor between these two rooms. He goes and sees on the mantelpiece in one room little Russian dolls, I don't know, 10 of them all lined up on the mantelpiece. He goes over to the next room, comes back into the corridor. Seconds later, all the Russian dolls are arranged perfectly across the doorway. So nothing really nasty, nothing really evil, but pretty spooky in the house. And one fine day, the sister of my student is at home with the mother. I think it's just the two of them at home. And this girl at the time is about 9 years old. Now, this is occurring pretty much pre the internet age, but certainly pre the age when kids had access to anything where they could get hold of the internet, this being relevant, as you'll see. The daughter says, "Mummy, who's that man on the balcony?" And her mother can see the inset balcony on the first floor, but doesn't know what she's talking about. There's nobody there, dear. There's no one there. No, Mummy, there's a man on the balcony with a grey beard and a skinny suit, and he's reading a newspaper. So the mother's a bit flummoxed, doesn't know what to say, what to do, talks the girl out of it eventually, and she calms down. A couple of weeks later, they go off to a local art gallery. Now, this house, I should explain, was, I believe, either built or substantially kind of worked on, because it had a lot of impressive kind of carvings and bas relief, by a big local figure of the Victorian era. And I believe he actually lived there at some point. The house was well over 100 years old. And as they're walking around the local art gallery, the daughter suddenly stops dead, seizes the mother's arm, stabs her finger out and says, "That's him. That's the man I saw on the balcony." And it is the man who lived in the house, who has his portrait up there on the wall. So, yeah, when kids tell you something weird, sit back, take a breath and
listen. Nope.
I don't love that. Nope. Nope. Big resounding no. I don't love that. Oh, God. That's rough.
Yes, kids may tell fibs, and I get that. But when they're being that descriptive and that specific, there's obviously something there. So
that's why I consider myself lucky. I live in an 1897 ranch house that was built and has been built on to in the Virginia countryside, and I'm like, oh, thank God my kid doesn't come to me with this, because I would have to sell this home and move tomorrow. Nope.
Yeah, it's a hell of a lottery. I mean, there've been court cases about supposedly haunted houses, and there's no obvious logic. First off, you know, it can be a brand new house but it turns out it's been built on a very dodgy old site. It stays with a vengeance.
Well, we have to deal with Native American burial ground lore here in the United States. God knows. God knows. Bethany and I, being from Texas and Kansas, it is a long-standing thing and something you don't give any power to. Until you're confronted with antiquity, as it were. Yeah. So I think it's very interesting. Richard, would you say you're done telling us tales for now?
I think so, because we're verging onto a whole episode on ghosts, and I'd love to do that some other time. But that's probably enough spookiness for one night. It could be quite a spooky week, isn't it? So, you know, that's rational.
We're backing right up to it.
I love it because last week he did nothing but just disgust me. Like, I mean, in the best way. Like, not you as a person. What you talked about was just absolutely disgusting. And this time I'm like, oh God, I'm freaked out now.
You know, I spent the entire week thinking about Francis I approaching a Franco-Ottoman alliance with Suleiman the Magnificent.
Yeah.
And oh yeah, bro. I've got this sweet mummy purse.
Yeah.
Being low-key. I thought nothing about Francis I. And all the things that you read about Francis I, don't get me wrong. I love all you historians that have done all the works I have read. But just approaching the idea of Suleiman the First of the Ottoman Empire and being like, oh yeah, bro, I've got this sweet mummy purse that you need to check out.
Yeah. My mummy purse is bigger, okay?
Yeah. Well, I don't think Suleiman would have one. the very Western idea of that. So that is what has occupied my mind. Thank you, Richard. For the entire week is that the guy that brought about a Franco-Ottoman alliance and everything I've ever loved and studied, no one bothers to go, oh yes, and that man was the owner of a sweet mummy purse.
Coming back to life, isn't it, in these unexpected ways from
Unexpected, but I think you have formally killed all ideas of dramatic histories for all of our listeners. Oh, yes, this was a thing from Francis I, but he was also carrying around a mummy in his purse. You have ruined the idea of dramatic histories, which I think is absolutely fantastic, by the way. We have massively enjoyed it.
Much more of that to come. The history of disgust, there's going to be a lot more. There's whole great sewers, really, to be emptied into the pretty costumes of the Jane Austen era.
Oh, God. You're going to ruin those, too.
Someone has to do it.
Fantastic. Good. Yes. Good, good. Fitting. Guys, Richard, why don't you go ahead and plug thing that you've got to plug for us?
Thanks. So the vampire novel will be the next one out. The whole trilogy is called The Soul of the Vampire, so I'm just now trying to suddenly think of a title for the first installment. I'll perhaps call it Vampire City. We do love the city of Durham where it's set. And that will be coming to you as soon as I wrap a cover around it. And Talking Dirty, the History of Disgust, anyone finds they can stomach that and they happen to be an agent or a publisher, do drop me a line. What else? Smoke of the Soul is out in a much more affordable version now. It was £100 or so, and it's now about 10, and the cover is much better. The last chapter is thoroughly rewritten and gives you this kind of introduction to the journey which Jess was asking about, and which I suppose I've compressed here to a staggering degree. It's a bit like asking somebody to drink 8 years of alcohol in 5 minutes and not feel a bit drunk. Mummy's Count Vampires, again, in a global edition. And the one which we've been discussing, and Jess happily feels isn't too expensive, but I would like to see The Real Vampires out in a paperback version quite soon. So anyone can politely nudge the publisher or just mention their desire for that. That would not hurt, because at the moment we have this beautiful offspring of mine, which I raised with great love and care and difficulty and trauma over many years, and the publisher has now buried it many feet deep and sprinkled bullock's blood over it so that it's entombed in something not very accessible to any but the most fearless. But yeah, as we've hopefully raised, there's a lot of wonderful, disgusting gems to be had there, even for £14. So yeah,
I don't think it's as buried as deep as you think it is, based on my cursory exploration of Amazon today. The hardback is available. It's relatively affordable. I say relatively, it's as affordable as the paperback, quite frankly. If you'll buy it in the season, if you'll buy it in October, I can't say anything about where the prices are going to go after that. But then again, readers, Richard's writing career is not born off of his academic one. So these are not solely books that you're going to buy on a teaching perspective. These are books that he writes that are very affordable, very relatable. We ask you to go and check out on Amazon. I always put the links in our show notes. You can find it. It's relatable. Just look at the show notes. It's not that hard homework. God knows I wouldn't ask you to do anything difficult, because I'm not going to do it myself.
Right.
We all know that. So Richard, also tell us where we follow you at.
Yeah, thanks. So I'll try and put videos up day by day on various books and bits of research, sometimes politics, and Twitter at the moment, at Dr. Sugg, and I'll try to get to grips with Instagram, do longer videos in a while. It's a bit more terrifying than any demon or ghost to deal with this, but I'm going to try and get my head around Instagram TV so I can do some longer slots for various subjects.
Awesome. So, Bethany, where do people find you?
Okay, you can find me on Twitter at BethanySkelton5. That's the number 5. And on Instagram at BethanyRN24. I do not have any books coming out, nor will I ever, but I am cool. So I'm just teasing. No, but
listeners,
real.
I'm flipping her off thoroughly because I see her today for our recording, and she's a ridiculous human being, as am I. But I'd like to think, horse of the year, classier version. You can find me. Well, first, you can find this podcast on at Body Count Pod on both Instagram and Twitter. We're working on Facebook. We'll get there. It's just, most of our grandparents are probably on Facebook, so we don't follow it heavily. Then you can find me at Jessica B, as in Bravo Manor, like the house, not the behavior. Same thing I tell you every week on Twitter and Instagram. Can I just say, Richard, thank you for turning around and coming back and being with us again.
The thanks for being a terrific couple of hosts, and I'd love to come back with more strangeness at any point. It'd be a great pleasure, great delight. Brightens up these very dark autumn evenings endlessly.
Well, we'll let you know if we go into apocalypse mode after tomorrow. So,
yeah, it's as close as I ever get to praying would be this week, I've got to say.
Yeah.
But let's hope the future. Better. Yeah, the future is not orange. Yeah. Hope if not so.
Or it is not in my wheelhouse. Okay, it's just the god. I cannot wear that color anyway. So.
Oh my god, it's not my color, right? It's not my palette. You know, I'm a deep It's where we live. It's what we do. You guys know where to find us. We appreciate you listening. And we're going to sign out for this week. Bethany, are you ready for our bye-bye? Are we going to do it simultaneously? 3, 2, 1.
Bye. Bye-bye.